Don't patronise me, Milton, she said. I know I am. I know I'm good, but it's not that. Things have never been as bad as they are now. I thought when I enrolled that I'd be able to make a difference, but that's naive. Men like Mendoza are everywhere now. They think they can do whatever they want. Maybe they can. Maybe. And you know what? I am not just naive. I'm selfish. I have Angelo to think about. He's already lost his father, and then I got shot last night. I was lucky. It could have been worse. So I swore to myself that I'm never going to put myself in a position where he might end up losing his mother, too. So you don't after this, she added. That's when I'll stop. But I want to do one more thing the right way before I do. If De Lacy did what you say he did, then he should be in prison. I swore an oath to uphold the law, and so that's what is going to happen. If you want him, it has to be by the book. We bring him in and charge him, and then we let the prosecutor take him to trial. Milton had given his next move careful thought, and the conclusion that he had reached was inescapable. He couldn't easily get to De Lacy on his own. It would be too difficult, even though he knew that Hicks and Ziggy would volunteer their help. And more than the practical difficulties, he knew that he owed Josie. Logan had killed Jessica, and now Logan was dead. He would have preferred to kill De Lacy too, but there was a poetry to the idea of sending him back to rot in the prison that he had tried so hard to leave. All right, Milton said. I'll give him to you. That's not enough. What do you mean? All I've got is you telling me that he was behind all this. Milton started to protest, but she waved away his objections. I believe you, Milton, but that's not enough. I need to make a case against him. I can't bring him in just because I believe what you've told me. I need evidence. Ziggy? Milton prompted. Evidence? He said. Yes, I can help with that. Ziggy told Josie about the two payments into Logan's account and that Palemos, the company that had made them, was likely connected to De Lacy. She listened with an expression that grew more and more incredulous. So, let me just make sure I'm understanding this. You're making the connection based on the fact that a woman with the same name as Milton's ex-wife was involved in the formation of Palemos and another one from years before. That's it? Seriously?
Well, I know it's circumstantial, Milton said.
Are you out of your minds? And this evidence about the payments, she went on with increasing agitation. Not that I'd call it evidence. How exactly did you get it?
Ziggy started to speak, but the words trailed away. He hacked it, Milton finished for him. She put her hand to her forehead.
So you have broken the law to get it?
Ziggy shrugged.
It's completely inadmissible. It's useless.
Milton took a breath. She was right, of course. It was useless. Milton didn't need to deal in absolutes. He knew, of course, what had happened and who was responsible. His standard of proof was low. But Josie wanted to do things the right way, and if she was to do that, she would need evidence that would stand up in court. All right, he said. We can do better.
I really hope so.
What about if we could get a confession? She nodded.
Of course. But how are you going to do that?
Milton turned to Hicks. I'm going to need some help, he said. Chapter 79. Milton told Ziggy to find out everything he could about Logan, and then he went out onto the balcony. Hicks followed. He pointed to the pack of cigarettes in Milton's hand.
Give me one of those.
You don't smoke.
I used to. And it doesn't seem like such a bad idea right now.
Milton shook out another cigarette.
You want me to be him, don't you?
Hicks said.
You want me to be Logan.
Milton nodded.
I can't think of another way.
And they never met?
He never met De Lacy or anyone who works for him. I asked. They don't know what he looks like.
And you're sure about that?
Logan knew he was dying. Being helpful was the only way he was going to save his life. There was no reason for him to lie.
Hicks lit the cigarette and put it to his mouth. You don't have to do it, Milton said. It's dangerous. I'd understand if you didn't want to.
Well, I'm not saying that.
I can't ask Siggy.
I know, Hicks said with a wry laugh. He wouldn't last 5 minutes. Has to be me.
What do you say?
Hicks nodded.
Yes.
Milton put his hand on his shoulder. You sure? He nodded.
I appreciate it.
Hicks waved it off.
I still owe you.
They stood together for a moment. The sun was halfway through its climb now, and the big yacht was easily visible in the bay. As they watched, a tender cast off from the dock and bounced across the gentle waves toward it.
So, we lay a trap for him, Hicks said. And you're the bait.
Milton gazed out. I'm the only reason he'll come ashore.
And if he does?
Then we get him to implicate himself.
The tender slowed down as it approached the yacht. There was a boarding platform at the stern, with the bright blue square of the yacht's swimming pool behind it. A mooring line was tossed out and the tender was tied up. Milton finished his cigarette and ground it underfoot. Hicks dropped his unfinished cigarette over the balcony and followed Milton back into the hotel room. Ziggy had moved his laptops to the table. They left him alone to work. His eyes were rimmed with red and patchy 5 o'clock shadow had developed on his cheeks and chin. He looked tired. Josie was sitting in one of the room's armchairs with her leg up. Her hand was pressed against the spot where the bullet had gone in.
Okay,
Ziggy said after an hour had elapsed. Milton crossed the room to Ziggy.
How are you getting on?
Making progress.
His service records?
That was easy. They're limited, as you'd expect, but I'm in.
How much can you change?
As much as you like. But it's one thing to know that I can change them, and another thing to know how much it's safe to change. We need to be careful. It's safer to tweak the stuff that conflicts obviously with what they'll see when they meet you. If we leave the rest, it'll be less likely that anyone notices. Better if you can remember everything else.
That's fine, Hicks said. What do I need to know?
Your name is William Logan. Let's start there. We're lucky that he was around the same age as you. Similar build, too.
Married?
Unmarried.
So you'll have to take that off,
Josie offered, pointing at Hicks's ring finger.
Hicks reached for his wedding band and worked it off. He dropped it into Milton's palm.
If you lose that, I'll be a dead man.
Milton put it into his pocket and motioned for Ziggy to continue.
No sign of any relationship. You have an interest in slightly deviant porn, but we can brush over that. No siblings. Parents are dead. You have a flat in Shad Thames, owned outright. No mortgage. You have social media accounts, but you haven't posted into them for years.
Milton and Hicks crossed the room to stand behind Ziggy. They looked over his shoulder as he flicked through the various open windows on his screen.
You joined the Royal Marines at the age of 18. 1 year later, you attended selection for the Special Boat Service in Poole. You were successful.
No commando unit first, Hicks said.
You got an exception. Apparently, you were quite the soldier. You served most of your time with the SBS, but had secondments to the SAS and 14 Intelligence Detachment, both times serving in Northern Ireland. You left the detachment and had a sabbatical for a year before you went back to the SBS, where you were posted to Maritime Anti-Terrorism Operations for a year. 1 year after the posting to MAT, you were transferred to MI6. Details are a little more sketchy from this point on. It looks like you left 2 years ago and went mercenary.
There's no reference to individual jobs, although I've found references to you in Africa, South America, and the Middle East.
Is that all?
This is all off unencrypted servers, Ziggy protested. That's the low-hanging fruit. I might be able to get more, but the Secret Service is more difficult. It'll take a lot longer to get through it. And you're meeting them this morning. But I'll keep working. We just have to hope they don't have a way to get the material I can't reach in time, or, if they do, that there are no photographs or anything else that would contradict your story.
Well done, Ziggy, Milton said.
Ziggy nodded, evidently satisfied with Milton's praise.
Look at this.
He moused over and pulled up a new document. Milton looked. It was an internal personnel record from the Navy's Human Resources Department. There was a face-on picture of Logan and a list of details, including his address and next of kin. Ziggy had unlocked the document and, as Milton watched, he removed the picture and replaced it with one of Hicks that he had taken on his smartphone earlier.
Very good.
Ziggy's fingers flashed over the keys again. I'll change the pictures on his social media accounts. When I'm finished, it'll stand up to basic scrutiny. We'll just have to hope it's enough.
Very reassuring, Hicks said drolly.
This is crazy, Josie said.
She stood, wincing again as she put weight on her bad leg.
Are you sure this is the best we can do?
I'm open to alternatives, Milton said. But he's leaving tonight, so you'd better make it quick. She shook her head.
I don't know. It's just...
What's the one thing he wants? Milton cut in.
Me.
He made that a condition before he agreed to work with whoever it was who got him out of jail.
He's obsessed.
Hicks tells him that I'm still alive and that he knows where to find me, and I'm betting De Lacy's judgment is affected. He'll buy it. He'll come after me.
And when he does?
We're going to need backup.
Is there anyone you can trust?
In the department?
Milton nodded. She paused as she gave the question thought.
My partner?
She said eventually. What's his name?
Dalisai.
See if you can get him to help. We'll need some firepower too.
He has a shotgun.
Tell him to bring it.
Bring it where?
I was hoping you might be able to help me with that. We need somewhere out of the city where we won't be disturbed.
I know the place, she said.
Chapter 80. Hicks prepared himself, dressing in the suit that Logan had left in the wardrobe. He grabbed the shoulder rig, together with the Sig Sauer P226 nestled inside the holster. He spent 10 minutes obsessively checking the weapon to ensure that it was properly functional. He had expected that it would be. He looked up as he reassembled it and saw that Milton was watching him. The two men shared an understanding. It was a routine that both used to distract themselves from the uncertainty of an impending operation. Hicks waited in the lobby. It was midday now, and the sun was burning bright. A Mercedes GLE pulled off the road and glided up to the entrance. The doorman bent down to speak to the driver and then came inside.
Mr. Logan.
That's right.
Your car has arrived.
Hicks followed the doorman outside and allowed him to open the rear door for him. Hicks stepped down and slipped into the car. There were three men waiting inside for him. The driver, big and with a blonde ponytail that was trapped against the seat behind his broad shoulders, a passenger next to him, shaven-headed and with broad shoulders, and a third man sitting in the back next to him. He looked to be in his late 50s, although he appeared fit and strong. He had a full head of hair, although it was greying a little at the temples, and his face was broad and flat. His eyes were dead, and when he looked at Hicks, the feeling was disconcerting.
Mr. Logan, he said, I'm Major Albert Lane Fox. I work for Tactical.
Hicks felt a flutter of nervousness. That could be a bluff, What if Logan had been lying, and he had met this man before? What if that wasn't his name? He nodded to the men in the front.
Tango and Cash?
They work for us too. Shall we go for a drive?
Hicks nodded. The driver touched the gas, and the Mercedes pulled away.
Where are we going? Hicks asked.
Just for a drive, Mr. Logan. I'd like the chance to talk to you about what you said.
Ziggy pulled away. Milton was lying across the seats in the back.
They're going south, Ziggy reported.
Stay well back.
I know what to do, he said indignantly.
Milton knew that he did not know, that his experience in surveillance was most likely derived from Hollywood, but there was nothing else for it. He couldn't drive the car without being seen, and they needed two vehicles so that they could swap in and out of the pursuit and minimise the possibility that they might be made by whoever was in the other car. It was far from ideal. Hicks was in a car driven by men who were most likely skilled in counter-surveillance, and the only team he could assemble to follow them comprised a one-legged police officer and a middle-aged computer hacker who had delusions of being Popeye Doyle. Needs must, he thought. He had no other choice. He took out his phone and called Josie.
I'm on the move, she said over the phone speaker. Where are you?
He poked his head around so that he could see the sat-nav.
On the expressway headed south, just coming up to the bridge over the Paranaque River.
I'm on Carino Avenue.
That was east of them. It ran parallel to the road that they were on.
Get ahead, Milton said into the phone. Can you get onto the expressway at Victor Medina?
No,
she said.
Not there. The Longos flyover.
Good, Milton said.
Let me know when you're there.
We'll stay on them until then.
Lane Fox was quiet for the first 10 minutes as they started to head south. Hicks knew what he was doing. He wanted him to know that he was in control, that the conversation would begin when he wanted it to. Even though he could predict the behaviour, it didn't make the silence and the two big men in the front of the car any less disconcerting.
Thank you for your message,
Lane Fox said at last.
It was unexpected.
I didn't expect to have to deliver it.
Well, as I say, we were grateful for the warning. It seems that quite a few men escaped. Are you sure that Mr. Milton was among them?
Yes, Hicks said. I'm quite sure.
How's that?
Because he's tied up in a trailer north of Manila.
Lane Fox cocked an eyebrow.
Really?
Yes, really.
You found him?
I did. Yesterday evening.
And yet, he only escaped yesterday morning.
He was working with a female police officer. I was watching her. She led me to him.
And the officer?
Not a problem any longer.
You continue to surprise me, Mr. Logan. Your resourcefulness is impressive.
That's very kind of you. But I'd like to discuss it with Mr. DeLacy, if I might.
That doesn't work like that,
Lane Fox said.
He's a busy man. Especially so soon after his release. You see me first. If I think what you have to say would be of interest to him, maybe you get to see him. If not, you don't.
Josie merged onto the expressway and picked up speed. It was a 3-lane road, and she indicated and made her way over to the fast lane. She put her foot down and saw the rental that Ziggy had hired from the airport just a few hundred feet ahead. She closed up until she saw the black Mercedes GLE that had arrived to collect Hicks from the hotel. Her phone was on the seat next to her. It was on speaker.
I'll take over, she said.
Milton acknowledged her, and Ziggy touched the brakes to slow down. Josie went by, and as she passed them, she exchanged a quick glance with Ziggy. Milton was in the back. She couldn't see him. The car picked up speed. Hicks realised that he had no idea where they were going. Lane Fox spread his hands.
So, What would you like to discuss with him?
I thought that he'd be interested to hear that I can deliver Milton to him.
For the second time?
That's right.
And were you to do that, am I right in thinking that it wouldn't be free?
Like you say, I've already discharged my obligations under our previous agreement.
Indeed you have. So this is new work?
I don't do this for charity.
Can you prove that you have, Mr. Milton?
Hicks took out the phone that Milton had collected from Logan. He opened the photo album and tapped the one that they had taken in the hotel parking lot that morning. Milton was in the trunk of Hicks's rental. His hands looked to be secured behind his back. The marks on his face were visible. Lane Fox examined the photograph and then made an affirmative noise. He leaned forward and told the driver to pull over. There was a gas station ahead, and the man indicated and turned into the forecourt.
"Would you mind stepping out of the car for a moment?"
Lane Fox asked.
"I'd like to make a quick phone call."
"Not at all," said Hicks.
He opened the door and stepped out into the boiling midday sun. The Mercedes indicated that it was about to exit the expressway. Josie dabbed the brakes and watched as it slowed down and turned onto a ramp that led to a gas station.
"They've turned off," she reported. "There's a Petron gas station I can't follow."
She looked over at the station as she drove by. The car had pulled over and, as she watched, she saw Hicks get out.
"Hicks is out of the car."
"Copy that," Milton said. "We'll take over."
"What do you want me to do?"
"Head north. I'll see you up there."
Hicks crossed the forecourt to the gas station shop and bought himself a can of Coke. He popped the top and waited in the shade for Lane Fox to finish his conversation. He guessed that he was speaking to DeLacy. He knew, if that was correct, that the success or failure of Milton's plan depended on what was being said right now. He had no idea whether he had been convincing. He had been on edge the entire time, fighting down the paranoia that every comment and every question was a test designed to trip him up. Everything was predicated on Logan having told Milton the truth. Maybe he had been lying. For all they knew, Logan might have been operating from a cabin aboard the Topaz, and if the paranoia was justified, if they knew that Hicks was lying, well, whatever might come next would not be pleasant. The car horn sounded. Hicks looked over. The man with the shaven head had lowered his window and was beckoning him over. Lane Fox opened the door as he approached.
"Get in, Mr. Logan."
Hicks did as he was told.
"Mr. DeLacy will see me?"
"He will. Now, actually. How would you like to see the yacht?"
He closed the door. The car pulled away. Chapter 81. They turned around and retraced their route back to the north. Lane Fox didn't speak again until they reached the signs for the Alpha Land Marina Club.
"The yacht is at anchor,"
he said as the driver turned off the road.
"We'll transfer across to it."
The driver edged between rows of $100,000 sports cars until he reached a disembarkation point near the water. Hicks had seen the marina's clubhouse from the windows of Logan's hotel room. It was built on pilings in the middle of the water and accessed by a covered bridge. The man with the shaven head got out and then came around to open the door for Hicks.
"Sir,"
he said, indicating that Hicks should get out too.
"Are you armed?"
Hicks nodded.
"Please."
He unbuttoned his jacket, reached in for Logan's Sig Sauer and handed it to the man.
"Thank you,"
Lame Fox said.
"You'll get it back afterwards."
The four of them made their way through the marina to the water's edge. There was a tender waiting for them. It was a beautiful vessel, crafted from mahogany and metal, its chrome fixtures glinting in the early afternoon sun. The rear of the craft was taken up by a U-shaped leather banquette, and Hicks sat down with the driver on one side of him and the passenger on the other. He had noticed the subtle bulges under the jackets of both men that indicated that they were armed. That was no surprise, but it was a reminder to him that he was vulnerable. Ziggy brought the car to a halt at the entrance to the yacht club.
"It's clear,"
he said. Milton raised his head. They had a view down to the water and, as he watched, he saw a brown and white tender with five people aboard skim across the water toward the big yacht anchored in the bay.
"Not much we can do now,"
Ziggy opined redundantly. He was right. Hicks was on his own now. Hicks stared at the yacht as they bounced across the gentle waves toward it. The vessel was large and, despite that, still managed to look sleek and graceful. It had sugar scoop windows and a glass lounge that seemed to blend the yacht more seamlessly into the water. Crew in white shirts and khaki shorts busied themselves on the decks, making their final preparations. Deckhands cleaned the outside of the boat. Sun loungers were set out on the teak deck, the towels placed out on them, rolled in tight, neat cylinders. The tender approached the stern of the yacht. A deckhand threw out a line and the pilot caught it, looped it through a tow eye and knotted it tight. The tender was brought up close and secured, and the passengers were encouraged to disembark.
"Welcome aboard, Mr. Logan,"
Lane Fox said.
"This way, please."
Not all the men he saw were deckhands. Hicks saw four other men, big and with close-cropped hair, who could only have been De Lacy's private security detail. They were dressed in dark suits, they wore dark glasses and headsets, and had noticeable bulges beneath their arms, indicating shoulder holsters and handguns. One of the men hovered pointedly as Hicks clambered aboard, fixing him with an even, professional regard. Lame Fox led the way through a wide aperture at the stern of the boat and into the interior beyond. Female stewardesses busied themselves, tidying and cleaning in anticipation of their departure. Hicks thought it all a little vulgar. It was all about status. A yacht like this was hardly practical, and the costs of running it must have been exorbitant, but it served other purposes. More so than a multi-million-dollar residence or an Italian sports car, this was the ultimate projection of wealth. It was also the perfect location for business meetings where illicit transactions might be discussed. Lane Fox led the way to an open area where another man was speaking on a telephone. He had his back to Hicks, but as he turned, he recognised him at once. He was tall, with a pot belly that signified good living, a sun-beaten face and greying hair that was swept back from a wide forehead. He was wearing a pale blue suit with a crisp white shirt and cravat. His eyes glittered, matching the sunbeams that sparkled off the water. Hicks recognised him at once. Fitzroy De Lacy. De Lacy finished the call and put his phone into his pocket. "Bertie?" he said to Lane Fox.
"This is Logan."
De Lacy's face broke into a broad smile. "Mr. Logan," he said, "a pleasure to finally meet you."
"Likewise, Mr. De Lacy."
"Although in less than ideal circumstances. We're leaving tonight, as you might be able to tell, but we certainly can't leave until we've sorted out the unpleasant surprise you dropped on us. I'd like to talk to you about it, if I may."
"Of course," Hicks said.
"Come," he said. "I'll show you the boat." Chapter 82. The Mercedes had been handed over to a valet who had driven it around the back of the buildings that lined the boardwalk. Ziggy found it easily enough. There was a private car park where an array of expensive cars were kept while their owners went about their business in the club. The lot was open and inadequately guarded by a single man in a booth. His attention was facing outward, away from the cars in his charge, and it was a simple thing for Ziggy to walk between a Hummer and the Mercedes, shielding him from the unlikely possibility that the guard might turn and look into the lot. He reached into his pocket for the small device, flicked out the antennae with his finger, switched it on, and slapped it inside the wheel arch. The magnet attached with a satisfying clunk, and, without waiting any longer than necessary, Ziggy turned and made his way back to the car.
Can I offer you a drink? Tea? Coffee?
Coffee, please.
De Lacy spoke to one of the crew members, then turned back to Hicks.
They'll find us. Let's take a walk.
They climbed a curved stairway that was surrounded by scalloped silver leaf and equipped with an ostentatiously expensive hand-carved banister. The deck above was dedicated to the dining room, with baccarat crystal chandeliers, a vast table, and alligator hides and kudu horns on the walls.
Do you like my little boat?
I'm not sure I'd describe it like that.
De Lacy smiled, evidently pleased to be able to show off the benefits of his riches.
I bought it from a Russian, he said. I would have commissioned one myself, but I didn't want to wait. We can accommodate 18 guests. Perfect discretion.
Unmatched privacy, obviously. It's difficult to think of a better place to conduct a business meeting than in the middle of the ocean, away from prying eyes. The security is world-class, too.
He wrapped his knuckles against a broad, tinted window that wrapped around the superstructure.
Bulletproof, ultrasonic guns, and an anti-missile system too. Practically impregnable.
It's very impressive.
They walked on, climbing to the bridge deck. The yacht had been equipped with a stunning infinity pool, and as De Lacy stopped and turned back, Hicks was able to look out between two vast sun canopies across the water to the sea and beyond that to the verdant hills of the coast. De Lacy sat down at one of the shaded tables and indicated that Logan should do the same. He did, and, as he settled back in the comfortable chair and shaded his eyes against the glare of the sun, a uniformed waiter arrived with a silver platter that bore two cups of coffee, a sugar bowl, and a plate of biscuits. He placed the cups and saucers on the table, left the sugar and the biscuits in the middle, and, with a barely noticeable dip of his head, he left them and made his way back down to the lower deck.
So, Milton. Tell me what happened.
There was a jailbreak. He was one of the ones to get away.
A jailbreak? Really?
There was a fire alarm. The doors opened automatically.
They do that? I would have left them locked in to take their chances.
The men in there are scum, Logan. It would have done the world a favour.
Hicks ignored that.
There was a riot. The guards were overwhelmed. They had to send the army in eventually, but it was too late by then. They lost several hundred, including Milton.
But you have him?
Yes.
Might I ask where?
There's an old shabu factory north of the city. I did some business out here a few months ago. It's still there.
That's where he is.
Taped hand and foot and shackled to the wall. He's not going anywhere.
Can I ask how you manage that?
Milton is a very resourceful man.
Yes, he is. But not everyone is as careful as he is. The police officer who arrested him evidently changed her mind about his guilt. She visited him in Bilibid on three occasions. I was told about it.
What's her name?
Hernandez.
Who told you?
Mendoza.
Ah, yes. The tame policeman. What happened to him?
Milton killed him.
If De Lacy was surprised, he masked it.
Is that so?
Mendoza was sloppy. Milton found out that he arranged his transfer from Quezon to Bilibid, and there was a situation with the owner of the hotel where we staged the murder. Mendoza very clumsily tried to clear things up. So, yes, Milton knew he was involved. Hernandez set up a meeting with Mendoza, and Milton ambushed him.
And you were there too?
I followed Hernandez. Milton was there, and Mendoza came last of all. Frankly, Milton saved me a bullet. I had already decided that Mendoza was a liability.
And then you recaptured him?
Hicks nodded.
De Lacy used the silver tongs in the bowl to remove a cube of sugar and dropped it into his coffee. Where's the factory again?
North of the city.
Hicks picked up his cup and sipped his coffee. It was deliciously bitter. The caffeine would be useful. He had managed only a few hours' sleep over the course of his time in Manila.
Would you take me there? Of course, but yes, you'll want to be paid. That's fine.
I don't expect favours. De Lacy stood up. The same again. Hicks knew that Logan had already been paid $1 million. He stood too.
$1 million is too much. Half is reasonable.
To include disposal of the body?
Of course.
De Lacy extended his hand and Hicks shook it. Shall we?
When?
Well, no time like the present. Chapter 83. Ziggy slouched against the rail and looked out at the yacht as the tender was untied. The boat turned around and sped back to the marina. He went back to the car. Milton was down low in the driver's seat. The window was open.
They're coming back, he reported.
Hicks.
He's on it.
And De Lacy?
Yes, I think so.
How many others?
I saw three, including the pilot.
Four total.
If you include De Lacy.
Milton started the engine.
The tracker is working as it should.
Update me if they go somewhere they shouldn't.
Anything else?
Walk back to the hotel and clean up. No prints. No sign we have been there. Keep your phone on. I'll call if I need you.
The spot that Josie had suggested was remote and deserted. It was 2 hours north of the capital, down a road that led off the main Route 8 in the rolling foothills that surrounded Mount Arayat. The road was paved for the first half mile and then became little more than a track. It descended into a depression, a shallow bowl in the landscape that was fringed with large trees. It provided natural cover for the structures that he saw at the bottom of the bowl. There were rickety-looking shacks and two old trailers. There were also two cars. Milton recognised Josie's and parked behind it. The second car was nearby. He didn't recognise it. Josie came around a bend in the track and raised her hand in greeting. Milton got out of the car. It was sweltering hot.
Is this it? He asked.
She nodded.
Milton looked at the collection of buildings. None of them were permanent. One of the trailers was no more than a burned-out shell, and three small corrugated iron huts slouched nearby.
A chain had been strung up between two trees on either side of the road, blocking the way ahead.
Would it be okay? She asked.
What was it?
They made shabu here, she said.
Meth?
She nodded.
The trailer caught fire? My partner busted them last week.
No one comes down here.
I've just had a look. It doesn't look like it.
Well, it looks good.
Milton started to work out the best way to proceed.
Are they coming?
She asked him.
They're on the way, so we need to move.
Manuel's over there.
They set off towards the trailers. Josie limped heavily on her cane, each step eliciting a wince of pain.
Are you all right?
Hurts like hell.
You don't have to be here.
Yes, she said firmly. I do.
They reached the two trailers. The one that had caught fire had been completely destroyed. The windows were gone and the roof had been consumed. The second was intact, and someone had propped a shotgun against the side. The door opened as they approached, and a man stepped out.
Manuel Dalisay, Josie said. He's my partner. Manuel,
This is Milton.
Milton pursed his lips. Just him.
You told me to ask someone I trusted.
I was hoping for... I trust him, she said. I don't trust anyone else.
The man looked nervous, and Milton's negative reaction was making it worse.
Milton put out his hand. I'm John, he said as they shook. Thank you for coming.
She said it would be dangerous, Dallas I said as he collected the shotgun.
You think we need more police?
More would have been better, he said.
And then, when Dallas I grimaced and Josie frowned, he added, but the man coming here thinks that he's going to find something else. There are four of them. If we're careful, we'll be able to surprise them. We've got enough.
Okay,
Dallas I said uncertainly. Milton glanced down at the shotgun.
You know how to use that?
Sure I do. You got another one? In the trunk.
So we'll be just fine.
Did you bring the other things I asked for? Josie said to him. Dallas I nodded back to the second car. In back with the shotgun, he said.
Milton knew that Josie didn't trust many people in the department, but he was not impressed with Dallas I.
But no matter how querulous he looked, the man was here and willing to help, and that stood for something.
Ziggy had said that De Lacy was bringing three other men with him. De Lacy had four guns and Milton had three, with Hicks as a wild card. He knew that De Lacy's men would be professionals and they were likely to be better armed. Josie was hurt and Dallas I didn't fill him with confidence. On the other hand, Milton had surprise on his side. He would have to hope that that would be enough.
He looked at his watch. It had taken him 2 hours to drive up here.
Ziggy had called en route to tell him that the tracker was reporting that the Mercedes was also headed north on Route 8 and that he had a 15-minute head start on them.
When would they get here? Josie asked.
15 minutes, he said. 20 minutes maximum.
Then we need to set up. Where do you want us?
De Lacy was in the front with the driver, the man with the ponytail. Hicks was in one of the back seats with the shaven-headed man on one side of him and another similar specimen from the security detail on the other. The driver turned around.
Where now?
They had been driving for nearly 2 hours. Mount Ararat had started as a rumple on the horizon, but now it dominated the way ahead. Hicks had told them to take Route 8 and head for San Fernando. He had never been to the site that Josie had chosen, but she had described it in detail, and then Ziggy had driven him there with the benefit of Google Street View.
You're going to come up to a road on the right, he said. Goes to Magalang. Take it.
The driver grunted his understanding and returned his attention to the road. Hicks heard the sound of a phone's chimes. De Lacy reached into his pocket and took out his phone. He looked at the display, his expression inscrutable.
Everything all right? Hicks asked.
Just business, he said. I have rather a lot going on, as you might imagine.
The men on either side of Hicks reached down and collected metal carrying cases. They each took out a Heckler & Koch MP5 and set about checking them. De Lacy noticed in the mirror that Hicks was watching them.
Milton is dangerous, he said.
He is, but he's chained to a wall.
Nevertheless, no chances.
Chapter 84. It was dark in the undergrowth between the trees. Milton stayed low, trying to ignore the cramping from muscles that had taken a beating over the past few days. He shifted his position a little, stretching out his legs. He was painfully aware that if his muscles locked up now, then he would be seriously reducing the odds of him and everyone else walking out of here alive. Dallas I had brought a second shotgun, and Milton had it. It was old and battered, but he was confident that it would fire when he needed it to. There was only one way that De Lacy could approach them, and, with that in mind, he had arranged the three of them very carefully. First, he had instructed them to drive the cars between the trailers and then farther down the track until they were well out of sight. He was in the vegetation to the right of the road, with a clear view along the track as it climbed out of the depression. Josie was on the same side, 30 paces to the north of him. Dalasai was opposite her position. Milton's instructions were clear. They were to let De Lacy, Hicks, and anyone else that came with them get out of their vehicle and make their way to the clearing where the trailers were. Then, on his mark, they would declare themselves and call for them to surrender. If the plan proceeded as Milton hoped it might, they would catch them within a crossfire. Provided Josie and Dalasai followed his plan, Milton was hopeful that the confrontation could be brought to an end without violence. 20 minutes passed. He listened. He could hear the steady chirruping of nearby cicadas and then the sound of a larger animal as it crept through the deeper vegetation behind him. He froze. He thought that he heard the sound of an engine. He watched as a Mercedes crested the hill and started to descend toward them. It slowed and stopped, and, after a moment, the doors opened. Two large men, armed with submachine guns, stepped out from either side of the passenger compartment. Hicks came next, then the driver, and then finally Fitzroy De Lacy. Milton stayed low. He clutched the shotgun and waited. De Lacy called over to Hicks. Here?
Yes, the trailer.
One of the other men spoke.
I don't like it, sir. It's fine, Hicks said. Nothing's changed. It's as I left it.
There was a pause. He's tied up, De Lacy said.
Wrists and ankles. Shackled to the wall with a bag taped over his head.
Thank you. Now, get on your knees, please. Milton tensed. He parted the fronds before his face so that he had a slightly better view. Hicks had turned back to De Lacy, and Milton couldn't see his face.
What?
He said. Knees. Now. Milton squinted between the branches. One of the men, a broad-shouldered thug with a shaven head, had stepped up to Hicks, his MP5 aimed squarely at his chest. He jabbed his finger toward the ground.
What are you doing?
Hicks said, doing a good job of maintaining his composure. The shaven-headed man closed quickly and struck Hicks with the butt of the pistol. He stumbled back and dropped down to one knee. The other man, a heavy with a long blonde ponytail, trained his MP5 on Hicks.
Milton!
De Lacy called out.
Where are you?
Milton held his breath. De Lacy pointed to the trailer. Shoot it, he said to the man with the shaved head. He aimed the MP5 and pulled the trigger. The submachine gun fired on full auto, a barrage of rounds striking the thin metal walls of the old trailer. The glass blew apart and fell with loud crashes, and the metal popped as the rounds passed through it. The man stopped firing. Josie was well placed. Both she and Dalasai were adjacent to the Mercedes, but, most importantly, behind the five men who had emerged from it. They all had their backs turned to her. De Lacy was in the middle. The driver of the car and a man with a ponytail were on either side of him. The man with the shaven head, who had just fired into the trailer, was several paces beyond them, standing next to Hicks and, although he couldn't know it, nearer to Milton. Hicks was facing in her direction. He was on his knees and covered by the weapons of the two men next to De Lacy.
Milton!
De Lacy called. Josie glanced into the tree line, trying to see where Milton had hidden himself. She was pleased to note that she couldn't, that it was too gloomy, and assumed that De Lacy and his men wouldn't be able to see him either. She heard a noise from the other side of the track. She looked across and saw movement. Dallas Eye was making his way slowly through the bushes toward the men. Stop! She wanted to call out to him, but she knew that she couldn't. Stop! They were to wait for Milton's signal. That was what they had agreed. Dallas Eye was low down, trying to minimize the noise that he was making. She could hear him, though. Surely that meant that they would be able to hear him, too. She had to do something. There was a narrow path through the bushes just inside the cover that shielded her from the road. She parted the overhanging fronds and branches and started along it, trying to stay level with Dallas Eye. Chapter 85. Hicks laced his fingers together and put his hands against the back of his head. The man who had shot up the trailer was a step away from him. Hicks could have reached out and touched him. He ached with the urge to do something, anything, and fought to control his breath. He had to wait. There were three men, just a handful of steps away from him, who would turn him into Swiss cheese if he made a move. He had to trust Milton. He couldn't be far away. DeLacy walked over to him. "What's your real name?" DeLacy said. "Logan, you know what my name is." "No," he said, "I don't know what your name is, but it certainly isn't that." DeLacy knelt down and took his phone out of his pocket. He tapped on the screen and then turned it around so that Hicks could see it. There was a picture of a man there, late 20s, glasses, his hair already thinning a little.
"Who's that?"
Hicks asked. "That's William Logan."
"What happened to him?"
"What are you talking about?"
"Did he tell you that he never met his clients face to face?"
"He told us that too.
It was one of the reasons I thought your offer was a little strange. Bit of a radical change of policy. It made me think. So I had a word with the lads I've been working with at MI6. Good lads they are. Helpful. When I started working with them, one of the things they did for me was to vet Mr. Logan. It was hard to find anything much about him, but they went back into the archives and dug out what they could. They found this. It was taken when he joined the SBS, and you don't look very much like him at all."
DeLacy's jacket fell open, and Hicks saw the pistol in its holster. DeLacy noticed that he was looking at it, smiled, and took it out. He held it up so that Hicks could see it better. "Nice, isn't it?" It was a Browning High Power, but rather than the usual matte black, this one was finished in titanium gold.
"I love guns. They made me what I am. This one is special. It belonged to Gaddafi. They found it after he was captured. I expect you saw the pictures. They found it when they dragged his body out of that filthy sewer he was hiding in. It went underground, but I had a man find it for me. It cost $250,000. I had Bertie buy it for me while I was locked up. This will be the first time I get to use it."
"You're making a mistake."
"Am I? I don't think so."
He stood and pressed the muzzle of the gun against the top of Hicks's head. "Last chance. Where's Milton?"
"I don't know."
DeLacy pushed down, the muzzle of the gun pressed hard against Hicks's scalp.
"Milton!"
DeLacy called out.
"You've got until I count to five to come out. I'm going to shoot whoever the fuck this is. And then when I've done that, I'm going to find everyone who helped you escape and kill them too, starting with the policewoman. What was her name? Hernandez? One."
Hicks closed his eyes.
"Two."
He started to doubt himself. Was this the right location?
"Three."
Had he made a mistake? Had he taken a wrong turn?
"Four."
Where was Milton? Hicks heard someone crash through the undergrowth between the trees. Hicks didn't recognize him. He was a Filipino, and he was toting a shotgun. The man yelled out,
"Get your hands up!"
One of the men still near the Mercedes spun around and brought his weapon up in a smooth and practiced motion. Hicks watched in dumb horror. The newcomer stumbled out from between the trees, his feet tangled in a stray vine. The shotgun suddenly jerked down to the ground as he fought to maintain his balance.
The MP5 chattered and jumped in the first man's hands as he pulled the trigger. It was too close to miss. The spray caught the man in the stomach. He fell to his knees and then over onto his side, the shotgun tumbling out of his grasp.
No!
Josie burst out of the greenery from the other side of the track, the despairing cry still on her lips. Her Glock was raised and aimed. She fired. The shooter was facing to the side, away from Josie, and she shot him. Hicks felt the muzzle of the pistol pull away from his head. De Lacy had left his side. He had started to run. The shaven-headed man who had shot up the trailer started to turn. Now! Hicks seized the moment. He surged to his feet and tackled the man, wrapping his arms around his body and forcing him down to the ground. The MP5 was caught between their bodies, and Hicks held it with his left hand and punched with his right, driving down with his fist and then striking even harder with his elbow. Milton pounced. De Lacy was running at full speed in his direction. Milton came out of cover and clotheslined him. The older man's attention was distracted, and he saw Milton much too late. Milton's forearm landed across De Lacy's windpipe and turned him inside out. His legs flew out from beneath him. He corkscrewed in the air and slammed down on his stomach. Milton lunged onto him, grabbing his right wrist and forcing it behind his back and then sharply up, ensuring that the high power was pointed away from his body. He yanked up and twisted at the same time, forcing De Lacy's face down into the mulch on the ground. Hicks had rolled atop the second man, pummeling him with rights and lefts until he stopped struggling. Milton saw the garish pistol. He scooped it up and pressed it against the back of De Lacy's head.
End of the rope fits.
Milton!
Josie called out.
Don't, De Lacy said. It's over. You got me.
Milton gritted his teeth. He pressed down, his finger sliding through the trigger guard. He could end it here. All of De Lacy's money and influence and power could cause trouble later, just like they had before, but they were impotent now. It was just the two of them and the Browning. Milton felt the familiar old feelings surging back again. The power he had once reveled in. The ability to snuff out life at a whim. All of it amplified this time by the unquestionable certainty that this was the right thing to do.
Milton! I'll shoot!
Milton's moment of disinhibition would pass, and if Milton let it, he knew that there was a chance that De Lacy would be able to rescue himself. If he gave him the chance.
John!
It was Hicks.
She means it. You have to trust her now.
Milton looked up. Josie was edging around toward him. Her gun was on the third man, and Milton could see that he had noticed her distraction. The longer she had her attention split between the two of them, the more likely it would be that he would take his chances. They had the advantage now. It was theirs to lose. It was time to cash in his chips. Milton reached to the side and handed the gun to Hicks. He stood and turned to Josie. He's all yours. He thought that he heard the sound of laughter. He turned back. De Lacy was on his elbows looking up at him. His face was a mess from where Milton had struck him. He grimaced through a mask of blood and mucus and spit. But there was the barest hint of a smirk on his face.
What was that? Milton said. You think this is funny?
Do as you're told, John. Like a good boy. You should have shot me. You won't get another chance. De Lacy's head was at the same height as Milton's shin. That was convenient. Milton drew back his foot and booted him in the jaw. He's all yours, he said to Josie again as he crossed the clearing to secure the man she was covering. Chapter 86. Josie sat across the table from De Lacy. The digital recorder was between them, and the camera in the corner of the room focused its little black eye.